Hi, this is Dana Stevens, Slate's movie critic, and I'm here with a Slate spoiler special podcast on, help me with the full title here, Dan, The Twilight Saga, New Moon.
That's correct.
Part two in the Twilight Saga, based on the best-selling vampire novels by Stephanie Meyer. And joining me remotely, which is why we may sound a little bit different, a little bit worse than usual, but we're working on this exciting new tape-from-home technology that will enable us to do many more spoilers. So joining me from his home is in Washington, D.C., is Dan Coyce. Hi, Dan.
Hey, how are you?
Good. And as regular listeners know, Dan Coyce is our favorite go-to spoiler partner. He's a film critic for The Washington Post, for the website True Slant, and also a contributor to Vulture, which is the New York Magazine culture blog. So, your job description having taken up three-quarters of our time, Dan.
And the title having taken up the other quarter.
Right, exactly. We'll have to say goodbye now. Thanks for joining me. So I don't actually know what your reaction to Twilight New Moon was, because I just saw it last night, have not heard from you since seeing it. So let's roll just with, did you like it? Do you recommend it?
My reaction to it is sort of inseparable from the reaction of the hundreds of screaming women surrounding me. I mean, which is to say that seeing this movie was a totally enjoyable movie-going experience, even though a lot of the enjoyment didn't have so much to do with the movie and had a lot to do with the sort of carnival atmosphere surrounding it.
Yeah, the audience is a big part of the enjoyment of this movie, and I saw it at a screening that was largely press, so it wasn't as squealy, but I still think that there's a lot of erotic energy between the audience and the screen in this movie, and that makes it really fun to see.
It does. I mean, that's actually ex-Slate critic, now New York critic, David Edelstein, posted his review this afternoon, and one of the things that he says, which I really distinctly agree with, is that the time to see this movie is not on home video. The time to see this movie is in the next week, if you can, and preferably this weekend. And honestly, I would say preferably, you know, at a midnight show, because a great deal of the fun and spirit of this experience comes from joining in, as you say, sort of like the so as much erotic energy as it would take to fuel New York.
Or Forks, Washington could run on so much energy.
Could absolutely.
I can't wait to read what David said on it. That's funny. The studio is going to love that he said, you must see Twilight this weekend, right. Midnight screening.
Right. I think he couched it in such a way so that they can't tease a quote out of it. Like, the movie's not that great, but if you're going to see it.
Right. Well, actually, I did think it was pretty great. I feel like I'm going to be one of its few defenders, but I don't know how much of a leg I have to stand on outside of just my sheer enjoyment. Let's start off with a quick story summary, although we can sort of assume, well, first of all, everyone should assume that we're going to spoil the movie, as given away in the name Slate Spoiler Special, so don't listen to this if you don't want anything spoiled. But we can also, I think, safely assume that most of the intended audience for this movie has either read the books or at least seen the first Twilight movie, right?
Right, and most likely has had, at long involved conversations with friends on the internet about what the movie would be like. Conversations that the movie does not skimp on rewarding, with, you know, introductory shots of Edward walking in slow motion with squealing guitar behind him. I mean, the intros in this movie sort of reminded me of when you go to a Broadway play with Bernadette Peters and they make sure that, like, Bernadette steps out on stage and there's a 10-second pause in the action so the audience can applaud her. Like, they have this in that movie, except for it's Robert Pattinson, and it's a 10-second pause so that the audience can scream at the tops of their lungs.
Yeah, they definitely know how to do their reveal. But so, right. Just in case people are saying, huh, Edward, Robert Pattinson, wow, let's catch them up.
It takes place in Forks, Washington. It's the second in a series, as you said. And at the beginning of the book, Bella, who is a high school senior, is deep into her relationship with Edward, who is a 109-year-old vampire. Who looks 17. Although, I mean, let's be fair, he looks 23, but he's meant to look 17.
He's movie 17.
He's movie 17, sure. He passes for movie 17. They fell in love in the last movie, Twilight, and now are sort of deep into their relationship, but the relationship hits a snag when, at Bella's 18th birthday party at the home of Edward and his vampire quote-unquote relatives, fellow vampires who have sworn not to eat humans, although they find it very difficult not to do so, Bella slices her finger. She gets a paper cut on a piece of wrapping paper, and the blood causes a near riot in the house as some vampires try to eat her, and some vampires have to retire queasily to other rooms and
I just have to burst in and say, didn't you think that was an intentionally funny moment? I mean, this is actually one of my pieces of ammunition against the haters who are going to say this movie is so solemn and self-important. I think the fact that a paper cut sparks the first big action scene of the movie is actually kind of a joke on our expectations of the vampire movie, and I really liked it.
Yeah, and they have, like, the portentous shot of a single drop of blood hitting the white carpet. So with that experience fresh in his mind, Edward, Bella's boyfriend, realizes that he just may not be right for her, that living with him, being with him forever might always leave her in danger, and he dumps her. And all the Cullens, all of Edward's family, take off to points unknown, and this is really the first 10 minutes of the movie, and those who are not that familiar with the story may be pretty shocked that, in fact, other than a couple of hallucinations, Edward, the series' marquee star, does not appear in this movie for, like, pretty much another hour and 45 minutes.
Yeah, he really just sort of lurks around the edges of this movie, which, frankly, is sort of the way I want Robert Pattinson. I want him as quiet and around the edges as possible, because when he's talking, things only go downhill.
Right,
but
exactly.
I'm sure a lot of fangirls will be disappointed at his relative absence from the movie.
Right, well, yes, I agree with you that when he's talking, it takes away from his strong points, let's just say. So the movie then turns to the third in the Twilight series' love triangle, who is Jacob Black, who is a Native American who lives on a res near Forks, and who Bella briefly met and befriended in the previous movie. And in this movie, she and Jacob become very close. He helps her and becomes the only sort of human link to the world for her after she's deep in self-pity and grief at being dumped by her vampire boyfriend. And there's this whole subplot about how she becomes an adrenaline junkie because when she does dangerous things, she imagines Edward telling her to stop, like some kind of supernatural scold. Jacob and Bella become tight and become friends, and Jacob hopes for more, and Bella doesn't want to give him more because she knows she'll never love anyone the way she loved Edward. And a wrench is thrown in the works when it turns out that Jacob's a werewolf. And there's a nice moment in the movie, which comes straight out of the book, actually, in which Bella says in voiceover, like, so is everything true? Like, are all the monsters we read about true? So there are vampires and werewolves?
In the book, is there any answer to that? Does somebody come out and say, oh yeah, Frankenstein lives right around the corner?
No. Sadly, that question is not answered. But I have to assume that Stephanie Meyer does have, like, some kind of quasi-sequel, like, up her sleeve with the Swamp Thing.
And zombies? I mean, she's got so many movie archetypes to draw on.
Right. And then the crux of the story then becomes Bella and Jacob sort of building attachment, which could or could not be romantic, and it's teased at on a number of occasions that Bella may have romantic feelings for him, even as she claims not to. And then a last-minute effort to rescue Edward, who through a series of hilarious contrivances becomes convinced Romeo and Juliet style that Bella has died.
Right, because apparently in this universe, there's even though we constantly see people using the internet and cell phones, there's no way to communicate to Edward, who's apparently in Rio. Don't they show him with like a shot of the Christ the Redeemer statue behind him at one moment?
Right.
He somehow can't seem to get the message that she's not actually dead, and those contrivances are not even particularly, they're not worked on even very hard.
Right.
And so then he decides that he has to go to, it's not Rome, it's somewhere in Italy, right?
Volterra.
Volterra, you're right, a hill town in Italy where a guy who I like to think of as kind of like the vampire pope resides. He's played by Michael Sheen with, I think, a great kind of camp joy. I love Michael Sheen's performance as this scary head vampire guy who seems to be in charge of some cabal of super powerful vampires who are the only people who can kill other vampires.
Right.
And essentially Edward wants to commit suicide by showing himself to the crowd of humans, and then he will have broken the ultimate vampire prime directive and have to be choked to death by Michael Sheen.
Right. And we can dwell sort of all we want on the various hilarious plot holes in this, one of them being that we are told that the Volturi, who are the characters played by Michael Sheen and his cohorts, are the only people who can kill a vampire shortly before we see a bunch of werewolves kill a vampire.
Right, and didn't Edward kill another vampire in the previous movie?
Also correct. We're also told that Edward can read minds, but neither the internet nor mind reading can get the message across to him that Bella is in fact alive, despite everything he'd been previously sort of told. But whatever, the point of this movie is not sort of teasing apart the plot holes. The point of it is sort of enjoying the wash of teenage emotion as it storms over you. And I agree with you that in that respect, the movie totally delivers. I mean,
I think it's virtually the Morrissey album of movies. I mean, I think it so effectively gets at that kind of teen longing and pining that even as I was rolling my eyes at the movie, I was really drawn in by Bella's basic dilemma. You know, even the scene where there was a very effective shot, and I usually hate 360-degree shots. I think it's one of the most overused camera movements in movies, but I love that 360-degree shot when she's sitting in her chair staring out the window, pining after Edward. It's right after he leaves her, and as this slow camera circles around her, the names of the months appear, and she's the exact same kid in the same chair wearing the same clothes, and it says October, November, December. It just so gets at that feeling of being a depressed, housebound, grounded teenager.
Right. And that actually happily comes straight from the book, as in the book, right after Edward dumps her, we get chapter headings with nothing following them that just read October, and then you turn the page and it says November, and then you turn the page and it says December, and then you turn the page and then the next thing happens.
That's interesting, because it's the trickiest shot in the movie, and it sounds like it comes from a trick in the book, so it's an attempt to recreate that yep. trick.
But let's one of the things that I did really enjoy about this movie, and one of the things I do think sort of pushes it into the realm of an extremely pleasurable movie, even for people who maybe are not twihards, as they say, are all those scenes in Italy with Michael Sheen and Dakota Fanning.
We forgot to mention that Dakota Fanning, unrecognizable as in her first, I would say, adult role. I mean, I wouldn't even call that a child, right? She's a vampire woman who resides with the Pope, Michael Sheen.
An ageless vampire woman with horrifying red eyes. And so each of these vampires has a certain skill. Michael Sheen's is that if he touches you, he can read every thought that you've ever had. Hers is that she can basically cause pain. She can torture someone
just by
looking at them. She can cast the Cruciatus curse from Harry Potter without having to say anything.
She says pain, I think.
She does say pain one time, but then another time she doesn't bother. But one of the things that is revealed in this movie that will have a great deal to do with the rest of the series and with Bella's experience through the rest of the series is this notion that Bella herself has some kind of power. We learn in the first movie that Edward cannot read Bella. He can read minds of those around him, but he cannot read Bella. She's unreadable to him. And we learn that Bella is, in fact, immune to the powers of other vampires as well. She can't be read by Michael Sheen, and she can't be caused pain by Dakota Fanning.
That detail is so perfect for the allegory of teen love that this whole series is, I think, because Bella needs some kind of power, right? I mean, she'd be a completely passive victim and object if she was just this powerless mortal with all these super hot, cool, excellent, super-powered vampires around her.
Right.
So the fact that she's given this immunity gives her almost like a playing card.
Right, although it's one that... it's one that she doesn't really utilize yet in the series, and that is, I think, one of the great problems that people have with the series, and certainly one that I frequently have with the series, is that she is such like a passive heroine and one who spends so much of her time just loudly insisting that she's worthless and no one could ever love her, while people, you know, boys fight over her.
I really want to get back to that, because my question as to whether this is a completely anti-feminist and therefore despicable series, or whether in a weird subversive way it is somewhat feminist or at least privileging of female experience, is something I want to talk about and cover. But let's take a break first to talk about our sponsor for a second.
Sure.
So, you can help me out with this. There's actually some new information from Audible.com, but as regular podcast listeners know, Slate has a special relationship with Audible.com, the provider of audiobooks, the leading provider of audiobooks online. If you sign up through our website, which is www.audiblepodcast.com/spoiler, you can get a special deal where you get a free book as you sign up with your membership, your 2-week trial membership. And even if you choose not to keep that membership, you can keep the book. But as a sort of special Thanksgiving deal for podcast listeners, Audible is adding on a true freebie this time. They have a whole bunch of just free audiobooks that you can get without signing up for the service online, just so you can see whether you're an audiobook kind of gal or guy. So the address you go to do that is www.audiblepodcast.com/Thanksgiving. And that deal is only good through, I believe, the day after Thanksgiving, the 26th. So go there and give it a try. And our recommendation, actually, for a book related to this spoiler is, you want to take it away, Dan?
Sure. We went back into the great history of trashy vampire novels and picked Interview with a Vampire, Anne Rice's classic, later turned into a movie with Tom Cruise and Brad Pitt.
A curiously enjoyable, though completely terrible movie.
Oh, yeah, yeah. In many ways, much like this, although potentially significantly more terrible than this movie, I must say.
It was also Kirsten Dunst's premiere, right? Wasn't that her debut, her first movie?
It was her very first movie. What I really like about this Audible experience is that it's narrated by the eternally crepuscular F. Murray Abraham, who gives a pretty fantastic performance reading Anne Rice's florid words.
I should remember this, but has F. Murray Abraham ever played a vampire?
I mean, other than in Angels in America?
Yeah, right, or other than, I was just thinking of his other very vampiric role, which is Salieri in Mozart.
Right, I mean, those are both Roy Cohn and Salieri are basically vampires walking the earth, only without the immortality.
He is eternally crepuscular. He's perfect for that voice role. Okay, so back to our movie. The last question we were talking about was whether this movie is a nightmare for feminists or sort of... nobody's going to argue it's a dream come true for feminists, but is it in a way a dream realized for women? I mean, it definitely does take place in a very female dream space, which I think is why this movie is going to be so harshed on. You know, I mean, I sort of feel like men get to have their crass movie fantasies and just proudly enjoy them.
Right.
But when women do, they're always so demeaned. And something about this movie just, I think, is really speaks to a lot of women. And it's hard to completely... dismiss it because of that.
Well, it certainly does speak to women, I mean, of all ages. And I mean, I talk about sort of the overheated teenage lust surrounding me at the screening, but there were plenty of moms and 20-somethings and 30-somethings who were also screaming just as loud at the screen. And there's an entire culture out there of Twilight-loving moms and Twilight-loving Twilight-loving grown-ups who find that this taps into some kind of very archetypal experience of teenagerhood that is still very fresh in their minds. This idea of a hopeless love and feeling powerless, but having some kind of secret power deep within you that hopefully one day you will be able to tap.
You may not know the answer to this, but is there a significant gay following for Twilight?
I don't know the answer to this, but I know that there is a significant gay following for Robert Pattinson's chest.
Mm-hmm. What about Taylor Lautner, who plays Jacob the Wolf Boy?
He certainly will be building a gay following once this movie comes out.
The movie goes to great, great lengths, and again, I think it's kind of intentionally funny about the ridiculous buffness of Taylor Lautner. And there was, I think, the biggest laugh moment in the movie was just when he took his shirt off. There was just something so funny about the triumphant way that Taylor Lautner took his shirt off, like, oh yeah, we'll top this.
Well, and I really like the movie as sort of a litmus test for the appeal of, like, the two archetypes of guys that you can be interested in. Do you want sort of the thin, sallow, pale, brainy poet, the guy who literally quotes Shakespeare from memory in the middle of this movie? Or do you want the buff, action-oriented...
Motorcycle-fixing,
bad-movie-loving dude who's really sensitive at heart? I mean, which one do you want? And it's funny in that I am much more the former, but watching this movie turned me it put me firmly on the side of Team Jacob.
Yeah, I have to say I came out of this movie Team Jacob too, but that may just be because Robert Pattinson to me is such an uncompelling performer. He looks the part beautifully. I can't really imagine anyone else being cast just because he looks so right.
Right.
But I just can't imagine preferring him over, you know, someone who seems like an actual chunk of living flesh. Quite a handsome chunk of living flesh like Taylor Lautner. Although I think that Jacob should never have cut his hair. He looked really great with the long flowing locks.
Yeah, someone has already complained to me that... was it you? That once he cuts his hair, he just looks unfortunately like a less handsome Matt Damon.
Yeah, that was me. He becomes like the ethnic. He's like the Native American Matt Damon all of a sudden, right. And that just is not sexy. But I just want to close on the observation that there's something really great about a movie in which the wholesome relationship choice for the woman is the werewolf and not the vampire, right? I mean, it's to me sort of clearly set out that to be on Team Jacob is to be on the team of Bella's emotional well-being, because he doesn't torment her in the way that her love for Edward does, right? So he's sort of like the nice guy, the good guy, the wholesome guy. He just occasionally turns into a ravenous lupine beast that wants to tear her flesh from her bones.
Right. But he won't hurt her feelings. He promises he'll never hurt her feelings.
And in this movie, it's almost like that's the biggest fear, right? I mean, Bella actually wants to be turned into a vampire, and it doesn't even seem like she'd mind becoming food for the vampires.
Right.
But what she can't bear is to live in this eternal teenage hell that her love for Edward keeps her in.
Well, I guess maybe that's the source of the connection for so many people. I mean, not just women, but people, is how many of us haven't wanted to just get out of this teenage hell, and honestly, you could kill us if that's what it took, man. If you killed us with love, we'd be happy.
Right. Well, what do you have any observations or expectations for Eclipse, which is coming out pretty quickly now? It's going to be out, I think, in the middle of next year.
I have none, because I have not read the book. I'm reading each book shortly before I see each movie. I've gotten briefed on the plot by my Twilight-loving wife, but I don't have any real sense. I know that there are some more battle scenes, which would be swell, because these movies, despite adding action that isn't even in the book, still have a real dearth of action and a real wealth of scenes of people staring at one another. But aside from that, I don't have any real sense of what it's going to be like, other than that it's going to make $70 gazillion.
Right. Well, are you a defender of the books?
No.
Because I found the book, first book, pretty much unreadable, although I did manage to plow through for the sake of the movie, but I'm not going to take on the rest of this series. The prose is just too bad.
I will say that New Moon is a better book than Twilight, but they are both worse books than almost every other book.
And it's a very strange circumstance in which I think the movies kind of supersede the book, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that the movies sort of deliver the pleasures of the book much more efficiently and without Stephanie Meyer's stylistic tics and sort of amateurish writing. I mean, there's a certain ability that Hollywood has to shorthand emotion and to shorthand passion that Stephanie Meyer spends hundreds and hundreds of pages trying to establish, and for many readers, establishing in a very real way, but to sort of casual readers who are not obsessive fans of the novels, the movies are a much more satisfying experience than reading the books.
Yeah, a quicker hit, a more efficient delivery system.
Yeah.
Well, Dan, thanks so much for joining me for this late spoiler special podcast on the Twilight Saga New Moon.
Thanks, Dana.
For Slate.com, I'm Dana Stevens.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.